Hey, I'm Peter Medlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge. And if this is your first time hearing our show, well, great news. This is actually a great episode to jump in on, but it's based on a really simple idea that we've all had teachers in our lives who helped us become who we are today. And every educator we feature on this podcast, whether teacher, coach, or professor, is nominated by the folks who listen. We want you to be a part of the show with us. Please do consider telling us about the educators who've inspired you and the folks in your community who deserve a spotlight. You can email us with your nominations and your story ideas at teachersloungeatniu.edu. And today on the show is our annual episode where we dive into some of the big education issues you should be paying attention to this year. And for the second straight year, I am joined in that conversation by Jason Klein. He's the Senior Director of Learning Partnerships at Northern Illinois University, and Jason works with school districts all over the state in his current role. He's also been a principal. He's also been a classroom teacher, a school technology leader, so his expertise is really, really helpful as we comb through these topics. Now, obviously, this is not an exhaustive list of all of the important education issues in your community, in Illinois, or in the country, but I do think it's a good way to make sure you're tuned in to some of the biggest things that will impact students and their schools. Our conversation will revolve around seven prompts, like this year, I want more people to talk about blank, or this issue might not sound incredibly important, but hear me out. And before we dive in, I wanted to find some terms really quick. Some of these you may know, but just to make sure we're all on the same page. We talk a lot about evidence-based funding, which is the system Illinois uses to fund K-12 schools. It weighs 30-odd factors and says, based on this, your school needs X amount of dollars to be successful, and then prioritizes the most money for the schools who are furthest away from that target, if that makes sense. We also talk about dual credit, which is when students can earn college credits while they're still in high school. And then Jason also mentions Perkins, which is a federal program that provides funding for career and technical education programming. Okay, with all of that being said, let's jump right into my conversation with Jason Klein about the education topics you should be thinking about in 2025. So the first one we have is this year, I'm excited about Jason, this year, what are you excited about?
Looking really across the state, so across Illinois, and this is both at what the state is doing as well as what's happening in communities throughout the state, I'm excited about the action taking place on kind of key ends of the educational spectrum. And by that, I'm really kind of talking about the ages of learners. So the continued priorities in Illinois remain, as far as I can tell, early childhood education, career readiness in schools, which kind of cuts across many grade levels and many ages, but comes to that head, right, as students leave high school, of giving them direction for what they're going to do next. And then supporting community colleges, which I think the question there will we be re-terming that this year, supporting post-secondary institutions, because it's possibly universities too with this proposed legislation that's out there on higher education funding reform for the 12 public universities. And so that gets me really excited because we know each of these topics can have a huge impact on learners. And investments in these areas are investments that we've got tons of research that shows that these are investments that lead to a really great outcomes typically, right? These are wise investments from both a financial standpoint and a human capital, human being standpoint. So I'm really excited that those are our priorities in this state.
And those are some things that over the past couple of years, those investments have really stepped up from what they were previously.
They have. And so they've been priorities over the past few years. They're not new priorities. And so maybe that's the thing that excites me most. I probably later on at some point, I'll mention the merry-go-round of initiatives, which is something that all kinds of organizations face, right? Not just within education, but particularly in a world where leaders like presidents and superintendents have boards that evaluate them based on goals. If those goals are changing annually and they're changing wildly, and those goals are the organization's goals, which they should be, that becomes that merry-go-round of initiatives. And, you know, people like teachers and instructors or professors can kind of sit it out and say, this will pass us by and I'll just keep doing what I'm doing and keep my head down. And then nothing really changes either. So even if we're successful with accomplishing goals like that, we may not have actually moved anything forward, right? We've got to do things long enough for them to stick. So maybe that's, thanks for bringing that up. That might be the thing I'm most excited about, is we're keeping our eyes on the prize for longer periods of time. What right. are you excited about?
Well, one last note on what you were talking about is that I remember last year, one of the things that we had on our list was about that support for, you know, early childhood and, you know, all that end of the spectrum. And I remember one of the things that you brought up is, this is a long-term investment. This is not something that is going to be on the list this year and we're going to check it off the box and be like, we solved preschool and daycare. We solved it all. Thank God we can move on to the next thing. This is something that is going to take years and years and years, which, like you said, that's something that is a different kind of challenge, like keep your eye on the ball rather than whatever this next shiny thing.
Yeah. And so before we kick to what you're excited about, then just playing on that to make sure people know, we did this past July 1st officially launched the Department of Early Childhood. And so in Illinois now, we do have state agencies and early childhood. It's literally called the Department of Early Childhood. It's not the Department of Early Childhood Education. And the idea was it was an umbrella department that can now address multiple issues around early childhood, from health and wellness to education. But now our agencies that are involved in education range from the Department of Early Childhood to the Illinois State Board of Education, to the Illinois Community College Board, to the Illinois Board of Higher Education, and then the one that people too often forget about but does also really important work, and that's the Illinois Student Assistance Commission. And so we now have five agencies that are directly responsible for components of education. And I mean, that fits in a state with the number of school districts and community colleges, other forms of local government we have. We have a lot of forms of government, but early childhood advocates are super excited about having that agency and feel like it's going to be really beneficial. So while I, with my P20 hat, continue to have concerns about how do we coordinate, I also hear loud and clear that those advocates are really excited about it, and that gives me confidence in that.
So the things that I'm excited about, honestly, I think that, I don't know about you, Jason, but this one actually was probably the most difficult question for me to get a good answer to. And it's not because I'm not excited about things. I think actually it's the opposite. Like, there were so many different ways to go, so many different ways to answer and think about this question that I had a trouble really paring it down. But maybe this is just something that has been on my mind lately. But this year, what I'm really excited about are the things that students tell me they're really excited about. You know, I think about, even from my perspective as a reporter, that, you know, over the past couple of years, we've really tried to make sure that we're hearing from students in like every single month, every single episode, right? Like, want to make sure that those voices are front forward. And one of the ways that we've done that is through this student correspondence segment that we do, where like the idea is that we, you know, follow a group of students through a club or activity. And actually, the most recent episode of this show before this one comes out will be specifically highlighting the journey of over at Hinckley Big Rock Elementary School in DeKalb County, that their high school, middle school, they just did their first like school production in like well over a decade. So like pretty much the first one ever when it comes to, you know, the kids at that school, right? And just like getting to follow that journey and like interview them over and over, and like the joy and excitement for those things was really exciting. I just want to find more ways to capture that, of like the things that, you know, as great as instruction is, as great as staff is, just like the things that really make students really excited to go to school every day and the things they look forward to, trying to find different ways to bring that into my work and to bring those voices in. I'm really excited about doing that more and more.
Well, as a listener to what you produce, Peter, I will say you're going to be very excited about one of my answers to a question coming up later based on the answer you just gave. So I'm excited about the answer I'm going to give later based on the answer you just gave.
Good. Well, let's move on. Unfortunately, we can't be excited about everything. We do have to talk about concerns as well. So let's flip over to that really quick, and which is this year, I'm a little bit concerned about What'd you got for that one?
Well, I have two things. They're not new concerns in education in Illinois or probably anywhere in North America. But they're particularly big concerns this year, and they're money and politics. And so, again, we could say, oh, every year of your career, Jason, that is, you know, 3 decades now, you could have said money and politics. And that's probably true.
Yeah. But I'm if there's a year concerned. Where you're like, this year I'm excited about money and politics, yeah, that would be notable.
That would be great. And I would love to see that happen before I retire. That would be fantastic. Or before I die. I mean, that would be great. But so money, I mean, the money answer is pretty simply, it's the projected state budget shortfall, the revenues versus expenses. We know it's going to be a difficult budget conversation in Springfield throughout the rest of the winter and spring. And really tough choices are going to need to be made. Evidence-based funding, since its inception in Illinois, has made a huge difference. Where the state's touting that we're down to less than 50 districts that are below 70% adequacy. That's a huge decline in the number of districts that are that far below their adequacy level. At the same time, I'll sit here and say, as someone who's studied that topic closely, we can't rest till 100% of districts are at 100% of adequacy, and that's not even our stated legislative goal.
Right, it's just 90%, right?
Is 90%, correct, which by definition is, of course, inadequate. But at the same time, I understand the compromises that need to be made. There's other things we need to spend money on, too. And, of course, if we could get everybody to 90%, then cool. We could create a new goal that's 100% of districts at adequacy. So that's going to be a challenge for everybody this year. And I'm concerned about that. And then politics and really does manifest itself at the local level. And we've seen this over the last 10 years in particular, where kind of national, international politics are just having a really significant impact at the local level. And that's everything from how secretly partisan are these board elections around the state going to be this spring? To how do we have conversations in places like school board meetings that are productive, local, nonpartisan conversations where people are listening and people are brainstorming together? How do we not other people and create schools that serve all kids and families in our communities? I'm really worried about that right now. I'm not in board meetings as much as I'm in school buildings and district offices and things like that. But like just last night, I was watching another board meeting live. I'm watching board meetings pretty regularly. It's a concern. There's a lot of really great people that are volunteering their time, which I don't know that the public realizes. I mean, I get that. Like, it's hard if I'm a member of the public to understand what a board member is, what the superintendent is, really even, I mean, the principal people have a pretty good understanding of from their own school experience. But it's real easy to then start pointing fingers when you don't understand that too. So those are my concerns.
That's something that, you know, obviously seemed like it was really amped up way more than it ever had been during the previous, I guess it would have been 2022, I want to say, or was it 2023, when we had those round of, like, you know, school board elections at the local level where it felt like you had, you know, a lot of, you know, whether it be residual stuff from the pandemic where, like, you know, school masking conversations or book bans or things like that, where we were seeing a ton of school districts. It wasn't just like, you know, hey, here's one or two districts that are dealing with these conversations, and also dealing with, in a lot of cases, like outside political actors coming into local meetings to, you know, talk about things, make a scene in some cases. It's going to be very interesting, and I'm definitely going to be keeping our eye on if it's a similar situation this year, if it seems more ratcheted up, if it seems less. And I don't. It, to me, I agree. It seems like, and I think that a lot of this is a product of politics and also like the media environment that where we used to, the phrase used to be that all politics is local. It actually feels like all politics is national in this way. Like everyone has thoughts about these big national, like culture war issue things. And to see that come down to the local level, like you said, with like volunteers for the local school board, it's going to be really interesting to see how that looks over the next couple months.
Yeah, I should mention on that, when we think about community colleges, I mean, the community college trustees, it's really the same structure. They're elected locally, and then they hire a community college president, right, and evaluate that president. We have not traditionally seen the same level of political angst in the community college setting. And I think there's a couple reasons for that. One, students are older, right, typically ranging. I mean, we've got all of our dual credit students who are high school age students, but then beyond that, typically ranging from 18 to 80, 90, whatever years old. So that's one thing. There's a different level of parent involvement. Second of all, while there's certainly the full range of academic content being taught at community colleges, there is a focus of many community colleges at both, while providing enriching both coursework and outside of class experiences and everything from the arts to athletics. There's that focus on supporting people with their next steps, either in career or in moving on to a four-year degree and matriculating to a university. And so I just want to point out the structure is the same. And so they could be flashpoints. I think there's some good reasons they haven't been. And I'm not hoping they will. I'm hoping we can... Again, and I'm not suggesting we should keep politics out of good conversations, but I guess what I want is civility to be in those conversations.
For sure.
I think that there's so many reasons for that. The fact that school districts function in working with and for students, for children, the fact that the educator shortage is not helped by political rancor, it's helped by a positive, supportive environment which teachers and other educators can grow throughout their careers. And so it's literally good business for a school district to do things in a civil way. But I'm also not suggesting that difficult issues aren't confronted. So I just want to be clear about that. I absolutely think we need to confront them to do our best for ourselves as educators and for our students.
Yeah, and I remember this is something that I brought up in a conversation that we had with a teacher who is also a school board, an elected school board member a couple months ago on the show, which is the idea that you really do want to have an engaged public, right? Like you want parents and members of the community, taxpayers, showing up to your meetings and having engaged conversations about it. It's just the civility point that we really want to underline here. And I'm glad that you mentioned the state funding piece of this, because that is going to also appear in another one of my answers. So we will be returning to that conversation later on, I'm sure. But for me, what I actually landed on was similar this year. I'm also concerned about money. But for this answer, I wanted to focus specifically on the end of pandemic era federal ESSER funding, which for folks that don't know, you know, ESSER is Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief. It was, you know, this federal pandemic era relief that pumped just millions and millions of dollars into schools for the past several years, made up a healthy amount of a lot of school budgets. And as of this fall, is gone, is ended. Mm-hmm. And Jason, I'm sure you could speak to this a lot more eloquently than I could, but schools, I mean, use this for just about everything from facility maintenance, salaries, technology, materials, like you name it, whatever it is. Most of the things that schools spend money on, they were using this money on. And so obviously it's something that funding drying up is going to impact different school districts in different ways, depending on, you know, obviously their financial positions, depending on the way that they chose to spend that money, if they chose to do it in maybe a more sustainable way. I mean, and this kind of era, it was so unique to have this influx of cash where schools got to also like do a lot of experimenting. They got to pilot a lot of initiatives and try a lot of new things. And the question for that, which is another thing that I'm probably going to talk more about later, is that a lot of those programs ended up being really great and like worked and helped students a lot. And now they have to figure out, how are we going to keep it going if we can keep it going? So And again, also the fact that it's ending during this period that we're talking about with state and federal funding being a bit more precarious, that's something that I am interested in, concerned about, and am going to be trying to follow exactly what that ends up looking like at various different districts.
Yeah, and I think on that point, the districts, unsurprisingly, that it will affect most negatively are the districts who are lowest resourced, which in a lot of cases are also the districts who may have the highest needs for these kinds of things. So we've got this one metric you can see on any school district in the state called their adequacy percent. And we've mentioned adequacy before. There's probably a whole podcast in that. It could actually be really interesting if presented right. But you want to be at 100% adequacy. That means that's how much money we need to educate our kids specifically in our district based on a variety of factors. And so we've got districts that, again, we still have 49 districts, I think it is, in the state that are under 70% adequacy. We've got a whole lot between 70 and 90% of adequacy. And if you're below 100, this is a concern. We've also got districts that are at 150% of adequacy and 180%
of adequacy. I was going to say, I feel like I've seen like 215 is like maybe the highest I've seen. Yeah.
Yep. And one of the things I will say, we need to be a little careful about that when we're looking at particularly small rural districts, because their numbers, the way the formula works, it can more easily put them over 100% when in fact, they do still have some real money needs because of the way size impacts expenses. But the drying up of that money, which everybody knew, I mean, everybody should have been planning for, which is kind of easy to say. You bought a round of Chromebooks. Normally, what I would have said pre-pandemic was don't buy the first round if you don't know how you're paying for the second round. Like, that's part of buying the first round. But all bets went out the window, right? On March 13th, March 14th, 15th, 16th, and 17th of 2020, it was like, oh man, we got to get devices in here. And then the money came through and you weren't going to sit there at the time thinking, how are we going to replace these? You were like, no, this is what we need to do now. And so it is difficult. And to their credit, many, the majority of districts have figured out some of those things, but the answers aren't easy everywhere. And again, that's a perfect opportunity for community members, for example, to be civil when they go to a board meeting and say, ask the question instead of pointing the finger and making the statement, how are we doing this here? What's going well? What's not going well? How can we help as a community? Things like that.
Yeah. And when I was having these conversations with school districts last year, as we knew it was winding down pretty imminently, the things that people brought up are like the schools that often, like you said, who are going to be impacted the most are the ones going to be that were already the lowest resourced and maybe had to spend some of that money on ongoing expenses, right? Like literally on staff, on teacher salaries. And again, some of that, you're going to have to figure out how to spend that money now. I mean, I think about school districts that also, you know, used ESSER money on school nurses and on school counselors and other like mental health professionals who, again, they've seen over the past couple of years the impact they can make. And now the question is really, oh, what do we do? Is it worth trying to find the money to invest in that now? It's going to be interesting to see. All right, well, we can move on. Number three on our list is this year, I want more people to talk about. So Jason, this year, what do you think more people should be talking about?
I have two and they go together. And I'll define each of them. But first, what they are is school improvement and data. But I think I want us to talk about them in different ways than we've typically talked about these over the last 30 or 40 years that these have been hot topics, at least among educators. And I'd like other people to learn about these, including parents, including community members. So we know things about school improvement. There was a lot of work done in this space research-wise, not just in the U.S., but internationally in the mid to late 80s into the early 90s. Some of that work was done here in Illinois, too, to be perfectly honest. And we know it's real simple. Have a very clear mission and set of goals. Not a lot of them. And do less for a longer period of time, and you will get further, deeper, and faster if you do that. And again, that can feel counterintuitive if I'm a board member, for example. It's like, why aren't we doing more? Why aren't we doing more? Actually, by doing less, we are doing more because we're able to really internalize these things we're learning. I didn't just go to one institute day and I tried something the next week in my class and then that was it. We're spending the next 2 or 3 years consistently going back to this and refining our practice to get better and better and better at what we do. And then it will stick and we will really be good at it. And so this is where we got to get off the merry-go-round of initiatives. And if we do these things that are so deeply meaningful about what we know about learning, about actual how humans learn, not how we do school, but how humans learn, we're going to see things like attendance go up, discipline go down, student learning improve, educator retention will improve. It's like win-win. And so why aren't we doing that? Because it's not how we've traditionally done school. B, there are pressures, elections, local boards, right? Like superintendents who need to be responsive to those boards, who need to have annual goals on which they're evaluated. So that's one thing. I want more people talking about that and about doing less for longer, being better for the whole system. And then the data.
Is there a turnover part there too, like an institutional knowledge thing too, where, you know, if we have people moving around or leaving or changes in leadership, where then, you know, sometimes those priorities can shift because when we have new people that come in, they want, you know, to have their own set of goals and initiatives and things like that?
For sure. And districts try to contradict that, or counteract it, I should say, probably more clearly. They try to counteract it by having strategic plans. Districts have gotten good at this by having the community involved. Again, post-secondary institutions, I think, pretty good at that also, getting everybody involved in writing this long-term plan that's about the organization and the community and not about me as a leader or an individual. I also think it's a chicken. The answer to your question is we have a chicken and an egg. And the turnover begets doing that, that then begets more turnover. So I don't know which is the chicken and which is the egg, of course, in that scenario. But I do really feel confident, both based on my own experiences as a professional, my experiences in this role where I get to work with people in local communities, but across the state, and then what the research says. And the research could not be any more clear. Like, it's a little bit like, picking up a cigarette in the mid-80s and being like, no, this is cool. This is not a problem for my body. Like, no, the research at that point, there was no question about what that was going to do to your lungs. And I'm not comparing too many initiatives to being the educational equivalent of, well, I don't know. Maybe I am actually comparing it to being the educational equivalent.
Yeah, maybe that should have been
a
line too. Your educational cigarettes
analogy to play out. That really is an interesting thing to consider.
Yeah, well, it seems like we almost have a little bit of a common theme with. I'm thinking about the first answer that we had about early childhood investment. These things that are investments that are long-term, it seems like that's one of the things you're thinking about this year is like, let's slow down, let's focus in on the things that are important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope that in January of 2026, in terms of let's slow down and think about things, that I hope that's the same story, because the research basis for that, like, it's going to take us years, decades potentially, to really slow down this freight train of education. And we need to. The research is real clear on that. The other piece of this then is, what data are we using to drive improvement? And we've made some marginal improvements there. We know to look at attendance data, for example, really closely. But we still continue to look at test scores. We still strongly emphasize them. We emphasize them at the individual student level. And I've contributed to this myself in my career. Though I don't think I ever said the test scores alone will tell us something. I think they're of limited value. We spend a lot of money and a lot of time, and it's not just the time kids are spending in their seats on them, the amount of administrative time spent dancing around, getting ready for this thing. And then afterwards, like, there is a lot of time that is spent, and I don't know if it's driving learning forward. And I also think that we're kind of missing some of the much harder kind of data to collect and questions to ask, but we're not doing those. And again, I will acknowledge those are very hard. How do we know you're really learning? How do we know what strategies will work better for Peter versus Jason versus these other two students? And again, this is an issue, though, that beautifully cuts across all levels of education. This is about how humans learn, how we know humans learn, and what we do in response to help humans learn. And this is true even in the workforce, right? Like, we want employees continuing to learn in their jobs. And so this is a biggie that I want more people to talk about. And I want people's sense of what data means to become broader. One of the things I will say that I think a lot of people in this space, and this is not new in this space, but is replacing the word data with the word evidence. What evidence do we have of learning? And I think that can really help shift people's minds about this. I do think that's a powerful anchor that can help people kind of latch on to thinking differently about data.
Jason, are standardized tests an educational cigarette?
There's an analogy. I'm not sure it's they're a cigarette.
Yeah,
I think they might be. You know, they're an educational scale. Like, they're the equivalent to like weight loss. Of the scale alone doesn't tell me anything, right? If I start eating right, I start exercising, and I start significantly lifting weights, I'm going to be replacing fat with muscle. And I may not move that needle on the scale at all, right? But I've changed my overall health and wellness significantly. And again, I think they're a good leading indicator. But I do also wonder, I said this to an administrator just yesterday. I would love someone to help us fund the study of 2 weeks into the school year, before kids have taken the week before kids have taken the local assessment that district gives all of their students, but 2 weeks in, so teachers have done all kinds of initial getting to know you activities, both personally and academically, to have teachers kind of say, this is how each student is as a reader, for example, and then see, does the money and time we spent on the test tell us anything different than what the teachers told us? Or are teachers really experts who are like, yep, I knew which my kids were doing well with reading and which weren't? And because I'm not sure while the test will give us a breakdown of a bunch of things, and certainly the psychometricians, the test companies, the publishers, they'll say, well, knowing vocabulary versus comprehension, like, that's really important. And we're measuring each of those things differently in different parts of the test. I've done a lot of work in this space, but I wonder, what then are we really doing with it? Are we then saying, oh, Jason needs vocabulary help, Peter's vocabulary is very good? Is the help we're giving Jason the right kind of help that's making a difference in reading overall or in vocabulary specifically? I don't know.
Yeah, it's a big conversation, and one that I'm very fast. I've talked to a lot of people about testing, and we could do an entire podcast where we analyze pros and cons and what helps and what doesn't on that. But I could go into it. We'll move on to what I've got for this year I want to learn more about. And I also have two things on here. And one of them, oh, actually, you know what? I think I've mainly just, well, I think I can synthesize it into one. So yeah, so for this one, this year, I want more people to talk about solutions, the things that actually work. And I think this dovetails perfectly into what you were just talking about with evidence, right? And I think this actually coincides really, really well with the previous answer that I had about my concerns about the end of COVID era funding, because there were a lot of, again, those initiatives, a lot of those things that schools tried that worked really well, and now they have to figure out how they're going to be able to keep it going. But yeah, so whatever that looks like in education, I want to make sure that we're talking more about solutions. And again, just like on the local level, these don't have to be new or old, but I just want a couple examples that I'm thinking about that I was covering in the last year or two. But like, again, during the pandemic, they were able to use ESSER funding for the Illinois Tutoring Initiative, and just like being able to, you know, spend a lot of money on doing tutoring that was either one-on-one or two or three in small groups. And, you know, it looks like, and from the schools I talked to and from the data I've seen, that for the schools who were able to utilize it, which were not everyone who was eligible for it, but for the schools who were able to participate, seemed to really help. And I'm curious about how those schools are going to be able to keep it up, or if they're going to or not. I mean, there's been so many big conversations about literacy and about reading in the past couple years. And in Rockford, a bunch of elementary schools were able to extend their school day and focus in a lot on literacy, and that seemed to help the schools who did it. So again, I'm open to whatever the topic might be. I just really want to focus on the things that work. I mean, even like, I think about from a totally different perspective, something like free school meals, right? Is something that there's data behind, there's research behind. In Illinois, there's a whole lot of schools that use a program called the Community Eligibility Provision, which is through the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which is a way for certain school districts to provide school meals to everyone, whether they're considered low income or not, just everyone in the school is able to do it. And 2 years ago, the state of Illinois passed the Free School Meals for All Act, which was supposed to give, again, as it mentions, free school meals to all. The one caveat, one problem with that is that they did not fund it as a part of that. So nothing has happened over the last 2 years. But I mean, that legislation just got reintroduced last week to fund it for however many, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. And it's just going to be interesting, again, to analyze things that actually work, things that, as you said, Jason, we have the evidence for. And I just want to talk to people more about that, because, again, part of this is a journalism issue, too. In journalism, a lot of times we focus on, and rightly so, concerns, issues, problems. But I think that you could say that I think that we have an obligation also to try to point out some solutions and things that people are doing to make things better. So looking forward to doing that more.
Solutions is a great answer to that, and your free meals answer is a great example, because when we really dig into what kind of solution that is, the benefits to students and learning are pretty obvious, but the local cost savings and time savings are not as obvious and wouldn't be to most people, nor should they. But again, I can tell you, like, literally in my head, I'm picturing, this is back in the days of paper forms that parents would fill out, but legal boxes upon legal boxes of free and reduced meal applications from the year, and keeping track of that and what the audit looks like. And hey, if this is what our low income percentage is in the community and every kid gets a meal, or if just by virtue of being in a school in Illinois, you get a meal, while we're spending a lot of money on that, we know there's an educational benefit. We're actually also saving a lot of money, or allowing local districts to shift how they're spending that money currently. And that's a huge benefit.
And something I think that you could appreciate, Jason, just like as a parent, which is that you don't have to think about packing lunches every day. You don't have to think about, you can just spend more time in the morning, spending time with your kids rather than trying to scramble, pun intended, to make breakfast. Just even those small things that we don't consider could make a big difference for families.
You know, those things do make a big difference. And again, it's been a long time since my kids were of the age where I had to worry about what they were eating for lunch now, but I remember it. And, you know, when it was a day that menu was such that, for example, my one kid, well, I'll eat that at school. Oh, great. That's just great. And it is, it makes a big difference. And if for a parent who's got three kids, It makes an enormous difference in the morning when they're also trying to get themselves to work and focus on the stresses they have with work too. And so, no, that's a great call out.
So this next one is kind of in a similar vein where we had, I want more people to talk about. This one is this year, I want to learn more about.
So for me, and this goes back to what we talked about for the first question, I know I need to really dig in and continue to learn more about people's perspectives. That's the only way we are going to arrive at solutions democratically, is if we roll up our sleeves and do that. For me, that at the center of that is listening to students' perspectives. And again, the movement we have made on this in the last 20 years is tremendous. School districts with student board members, students routinely on committees helping hire people, like students doing real things. And we need to keep moving in that direction. But you were a radical 20 years ago doing those kinds of things. And now they're pretty commonplace. And it's awesome. And so so that's, thank you to you for helping us with that too. That's what I want to continue to learn more about, the perspectives of all people, but especially centering on students.
I've got two quick ones for us. And the first one is, this year, I want to learn more about math, Jason. I mentioned that over the past couple of years, like the state is, there's been a huge conversation about literacy. The state had this, big statewide literacy initiative and campaign, and we need to get kids rehooked on phonics. And what does the research actually tell us about how reading is done? And it seems like we're going down a similar path now, but when it comes to math. And I'm really, really interested to learn, again, just more about what the research actually says about what works when it comes to math instruction, how schools are, innovating, what they're focusing on, what my own preconceived notions I have about math are. Fascinated to learn more about that. And that seems pretty imminent. The state is going to announce whatever their, math initiative is going to be. But any thoughts about that one, Jason?
Well, it's definitely imminent. There was some really significant research done in the mid to late 90s, including a lot of schools in Illinois, as part of the Third International Math and Science Study, which really hasn't been refuted, has made clear like this is, and some of it, we had the whole new math movement 15, 18 years before that, 20 years before that. Some of that, it turns out, was not off target, was on target. But again, like many things, how it actually gets done at the classroom level takes a lot of professional development. And so ultimately, that research done 25, 30 years ago now answered the question that, engineering professors at universities would say, I know you got a 5 on the AP calculus test, but why don't you know any math? And it was the ability to apply it to like novel situations. And so, and we've seen the state of Illinois has been a real leader in that over the last two decades. There was state exams, state assessments that ask kids to write about their math. And that's not like, oh, soft, we're not really doing math. No, they're doing the numeric part. They have to do the math conceptually, correct arithmetic, but then they also have to explain what they did and why. And that is like that. I was never taught math like that. Y equals MX plus B. M is slope. B is the Y intercept. We never learned what a linear relationship was. And this shifts that. And now kids learn what a linear relationship is. And then sure, they can plug and play Y equals MX plus B. That's the easy part. We never got beyond the easy part. And so so it'll be really interesting to see what comes of this. I'm I'm curious. I'm curious on the process, and then the implementation will be a challenge no matter what comes out of it, because a statewide educational implementation is a challenge.
For sure. Yeah, and the other thing I was thinking about, of something I want to learn more about this year, is just school procurement. You know, school finances are complicated, and as we mentioned, like every year, schools are spending a lot of money on initiatives, whether they be new or not, on technology and curriculum. And I just am fascinated to get some real, like, you know, teacher and administrator perspectives about, you know, what we're using, what we're not, what works, all that type of stuff.
That's a good one.
And then moving on, this one we have this year, everyone is talking about this, but what we should be considering is.
So two things. Everyone is talking about the future of the U.S. Department of Education. And I think there what we should be considering is. Probably there is not a strong understanding of what things the U.S. Department of Ed does versus what things the states control.
And in terms of the public, you mean, not a great understanding?
Or educators, I would say. And so I think what we should be considering is understanding really what that relationship looks like and what the work of the U.S. Department of Ed has been. That's like step number one. And I think what I just said cuts across the political spectrum in terms of my perception of there not being a strong understanding of that. Everything from post-secondary financial aid responsibilities to the U.S. Department of Ed's Office of Civil Rights, and then really understanding like what federal categorical grants, what does that mean? What does that look like? So whether it's the title funds or Perkins, and again, not saying those things are useful or useless. I happen to think most of these things are extremely useful. And then even understanding at the local level, and certainly in Illinois with the Illinois report card, it's very easy to look and in a couple of clicks, see what percent of your district's funding is coming from the federal level, and single digits in most places, and sometimes very small single digits. But also even in places where it is very small single digits, you don't want to see that money just disappear. And it's helping fund really important work, even if it's not totally funding that really important work in certain cases, like special education or CT or career and technical education. I mean, the Perkins money is great, but the state devotes funds to support CTE, and local school districts devote funds to support CTE to really make ends meet as well.
Right. And just to jump in really quick, I had the same answer for you as this on this one. I really wanted to find a way to talk about this issue because it's something that also people ask me about, like, oh, you should write a story about how, you know, school districts in Illinois were going to be affected if they shut down the Department of Education. And I'm like, nobody. It's a big thing, but no one has any idea what that even means, what that would do, because there's so many loose ends. Like, again, does it just all end? Does some of it go to different departments? I mean, to hone in on one specific part of it, I mean, you mentioned like the title programs, right? Like Title I is this huge funding mechanism for, you know, schools considered low income, right? This is like an $18 billion program. That's something that existed before the Department of Education existed.
Correct.
So, like, if the Department of Ed went away, would it just shift somewhere else? But then also there's, you know, policy things like, you know, Project 2025 that talks about, you know, slowly winding down funding for Title I. How influential is that? Is that something that is actually going to make an impact and would lead people to want to, you know, dismantle that funding too? I have no idea, and I don't think that educators or administrators have much of an idea either.
Yeah, so my one other one, and you used a phrase a moment ago that is the perfect segue into this, which is everybody's talking about it. I'm not sure anybody knows what it means. And that's everyone's talking about AI.
Oh, that's perfect. This is a perfect one for this. Yeah.
And what we should be considering is, well, so first of all, you know, there's not a single common definition of AI, even among AI researchers, right? There's so many tentacles to this. Let me, again, for anybody listening, I come from a background where one of the things I did for 10 years was lead educational technology work. And so I'm not one to like quickly sniff and say there's no place for it. Pencils and paper only. I think there's a pretty healthy balance. But most importantly, again, if we shift to the kind of learning where kids or learners of any age, excuse me, are creating, I will say the AI, certainly our main, you know, ChatGPT, Gemini, OpenAI, Claude, those kind of tools, we plug in a question, we get an answer. The answer often sounds very authoritative. And then if you squint and turn your head at just the right angle, especially if you know the subject, you're like, wait, this doesn't say anything. You know, I desperately want AI to answer my emails for me, like, or help me identify the ones I really need to answer. Because doing my work and doing my email, those are actually a conflict, right? Which is, I don't want to not respond to emails. I want to get back to everybody with a good, but AI can't answer my emails. I tried using over winter break. I fed it 10 things I've written and a link to a website and gave a question that was specifically about those. They gave me back 3 short paragraphs. And I said, yeah, this is terrible. And then I went and wrote it. And I probably produced about 6 paragraphs. Mine might have been terrible too, let's be clear. But even with giving it the information in my own writing, it wasn't able to reproduce the answer. So A, I don't think we're there yet. B, I think that we want kids to want to be creators. And that comes from doing engaging work and solving real problems. And then C, is, and I think school districts, I think, and post-secondary institutions both are really starting to do a good job of this. This happened real quickly. I'm real pleased about that. And that's, how do we teach learners how to use this and how to be careful with it? But all, so I think that's a sign that we have made real progress. But I do worry about just slapping AI on the front of everything. It reminds me of when textbook publishers took essentially the same textbook, put a new picture on the cover, and then stuck stickers on them that said Common Core aligned when the Common Core state standards came out. And there was nothing different about it, but I worry about that. AI just being something where people are like, oh yeah, let's use it, it's got AI. And on the flip side, the people are like, no, we cannot use it, it's got AI. And again, I think there's some really good work happening at all levels. I also think Illinois's privacy protections for students that are in place are a good guardrail against that. And I know school districts, that primarily affects school districts and not post-secondary institutions because the age of students, but school districts have really taken that seriously going back to just before COVID and have done a really good job of that. And that's still a constant training, retraining of people in the organization. Like, no, we can't use that because it doesn't meet the privacy requirements. So there's a lot we should be considering on each of these topics.
Yeah, it's like you said, I'm sure there's a lot of educational technology companies that are like, now is our time to cash in by slapping AI on top of it. And sure, it's happening. And when you have the next big thing, it's very easy for a lot of reporters to just like, I should write about how AI is going to change the face of education forever when we really have no idea what it's going to look like or what exactly the best implementation or how schools are going to use it, how students are going to, like, all that stuff is very TBD. And like we know about, like you said, things like ChatGPT, obviously one of the main conversations people had about that at the onset of that in education was about like plagiarism and cheating and that every student is going to be using ChatGPT to write their essays for them. I have no idea really even how much that's happening or to what degree or, you know, what that might be. I mean, I'm sure that there's a lot of schools that are surveying students about if they've used AI before, if they've used it to help them, but again, I think it's also just really interesting to have conversations about, like, sure, there's the idea of AI, like, writing your essay for you wholesale, versus I heard a fascinating conversation, and this is a slight digression, but a fascinating conversation with someone who's a composer, like writes a lot of music, writes a lot of music for things like commercials, TV shows. They'll write a jingle for a commercial or background music for TV. And they're like, this software could take my job today. Like, the AI software that they use is excellent. It, like, in the way that you were like, AI cannot write my emails for them, they're like, AI actually can do this. But they were talking about how they use this software to help them get out of a writer's block thing, where opening up, like, the AI saying, okay, well, you could do this, 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 or this. And then, you know, like, oh, I hadn't even thought of that. Using that to then, and we could have all sorts of conversations about if, you know, ownership and creation and all that stuff. But yeah, we really need to calm down about the AI revolution, because it's important, but also, yeah.
On both the AI and the U.S. Department of Ed, we should be talking about unintended consequences, right? So actually, in the school board meeting I watched last night, one of the things that was really interesting was they had a conversation about the energy consumption costs of AI use. And they were talking about it in terms of bottles of water or how many iPhones charged that would be. And so I think that's also really productive to start to really look at the wholeness of these issues.
Yeah. Second to last one we have here is, this might not sound incredibly important, but hear me out. What do you got for this one, Jason?
Well, so for this one, there are key positions, mostly hidden positions, in educational organizations at statewide, all levels. In a lot of places, these positions don't exist because they're small. There isn't funding for them. But examples of these positions would be family liaison positions, data positions, at the secondary and post-secondary levels, work-based learning positions. We need to fund positions like these so that people in other types of positions aren't having to do all of the jobs, including ones that they're not expert for. And here's the other thing. In the cases, like the examples I just gave, where do you go to become one of those positions? Like, what do you major in to be a family liaison? Maybe you become an educator, right? Maybe you do something else in a health and human science kind of background. Then you morph into that and you figure it out as you go, right? And people help each other in the handful of places those are. So we need to create specific pathways and pipelines for people to become experts and move into these roles, which are really, really critical. We need to look at regional solutions in places that have small organizations so that they can benefit from them, even if each organization can't have them. And again, these are needed from early childhood through universities, through, frankly, workforce development, all of these kinds of things. And I think increasingly I've come to learn these are incredibly important. We do have some people doing this work who tend to be truly extraordinary professionals, probably humans too, and they figured a lot of it out. Now we need to make it more systematic.
Right. Yeah, I mean, again, for that example that you used about like family parent liaisons, you know, helping connect people with resources, helping with attendance, and when you don't have those people in place, again, that falls on the same person who does that is the same person who does McKinney-Vento stuff for homeless students, who also is a school counselor that helps with mental health and helps with academic advice. You know, like, you're right that it can fall onto one person, or those things can get spread out to people if we don't have those jobs in place. But you know, I'm ready for mine here, Jason. This might not sound incredibly important, but hear me out. And this is a broad one. This is the 5-year anniversary of the pandemic. And the reason I say that, which is, like, obviously people know that the pandemic is important. However, the reason that I say it might not sound incredibly important is I think that there is a lot of cases that it was so traumatic and it was so big that we kind of don't want to talk about it anymore. And we're kind of sick of having conversations about it. But I am fascinated now that we have a round number, 5 years distance from when everything started, to really think about the way its legacy and education lives on, and in what ways we see ripple effects and in what ways we don't. I mean, I think about students who were in preschool or kindergarten in 2020 or 2021, missed out on some of those foundational days when you're, you know, just learning how to do school and be social. And those kids are in fourth and fifth grade now. And so I remember at the time people telling me that, like, those kids there, those are going to be the ones that are the most impacted by this for the rest of their education journey. Are they? What does that look like? What does that mean? And I'm fascinated to have those conversations. I mean, like, obviously there's issues like technology, right? Like you talked about earlier with, you know, Chromebooks. Everyone had to get Chromebooks on, you know, March 12th or 15th or whatever it might be. And, you know, we had to embrace technology more than ever. What does that legacy look like? How has that changed the trajectory of things? I mean, I think about issues like chronic, we talked about attendance, like chronic absenteeism, students who miss 10% or more of the school year. And that's something that skyrocketed during the pandemic and in a lot of cases is down, but has kind of settled at a point which is about twice as high as it was before the pandemic. And so we're kind of at a everyone's favorite phrase, which is a new normal, which is that maybe instead of your school having 10% of your students who are chronically absent, maybe 20% are. If they were 15, maybe it's 30 or whatever it might be. It might have been 2 before, and it might be 8 or 10 now. So all of those things, considering what the legacy, I mean, obviously I could go into, you know, schools investing into mental health resources, things like that. But looking back 5 years later, where do we see the ripple effects? Where do we not? And I'm going to be interested to have those conversations this year. In fact, I'm having the chronic absenteeism one right now. Next up, this is the last one that we have on our list, which is, this might not be on everyone's radar yet, but it's going to be pretty soon. What do you got for that one, Jason?
Well, I think this one is on a lot of people's radars, but I don't think it's really on their radars. And I want to apologize. Anybody who's made it all the way to this point, I'm going to be a little bit of a downer here at the end, but I hope to finish with a optimistic, hopeful flourish. I hope I'm wrong about this, but classrooms without teachers and schools without principals. It's a couple things helping us prevent this right now. Declining student enrollment is helping. Amazing new teachers coming into the pipeline, it's helping. And the funding that the governor's office has championed, specifically the teacher vacancy pipeline grant, has really helped avoid this so far. But looking at the revenue projections, the politics that we talked about, tier two is a disincentive to stay. If I'm 24 years old and this work is hard, like 43 more years of this seems, that's a long time. And so I hope I'm wrong, that we're gonna have more vacant classrooms and principalships. And that's a problem on the first level. Like, first level, there's who's teaching, who's helping run that school. That's a problem also on a second level that people don't think about, and that's administrators are running around just trying to plug holes constantly, which means nothing proactive and long-term is happening because they're worrying about who's going to be in classrooms tomorrow, like safety, like lowest level Maslow's hierarchy. And so they're not leading change. They're not focusing on their own learning. They're not focusing on improvement. So I think you've helped us here by saying you want us to focus on solutions. And this is where I do look with some optimism, because I think the solutions are out there in the research, they're in practice in places, and we just need to help make them happen everywhere, despite the challenging landscape in front of us. And that's less is more in terms of initiatives, and along with that, longer timeframes or more, helping teachers abandon what was done to most of us as students and shift to really authentic learning. And then helping build a mindset of considering educators as real professionals who have very specific knowledge. And I think we probably, one of the things I've learned from my work in career and technical education is that's probably something we need to do across professions, is, oh, there's people doing that work, and there are things I don't know about it. That is just a good mindset. If we could have that about one another's work, I think that would be helpful. And again, maybe that's a basis for a certain level of civility. So again, I hate to be down on that. I am optimistic. We've put students more and more at the center of what we do, and that gets me really excited.
Good. Well, I don't know if I'm going to have a positive flourish that you had, but I actually, my answer for this is something that you touched on earlier in our conversation, which is that this might not be on everyone's radar yet, but it will be soon, which I think is state funding for education. I think that as the spring moves on and as we get closer to those public conversations and state budgets and things like that, that's going to be something that people are a lot more aware of. We talked about what that looks like for, are we going to, how much is the evidence-based funding formula going to be funded this year? The law kind of outlines $350 million every year. Actually, just this morning, the State Board of Education released their budget recommendations and recommended that same thing. But, you know, we're going to have those conversations about education funding later on. And I think something that we briefly mentioned earlier, which is about higher education. There's been an effort for the last couple of years and really kind of culminated last year when they released the plan about changing the way that higher education is funded in Illinois to kind of more closely mirror that evidence-based funding system that K-12 has. And that's obviously something that's going to cost more money, right? So when we're having these conversations at the same time as, you know, we've got these budget shortfalls, we're going to really have to weigh those interests, and it's going to be something that comes up. I'm sure people are going to be aware of, and I think that's something that people should have on their minds because it's going to be a big issue, once we get towards April, May of this year. So keep that in mind. And that was pretty much all we had. So Jason, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I'm always happy when we get to have a large-scale, thoughtful conversation about the state of education. So I really appreciate you taking the time to do this because I know you got lots of things to do and AI is not going to do them for you.
No, AI is not going to do it for me. And likewise, Peter, this was great. Thanks for all the attention you shine on the issues that educators at all levels across Illinois and beyond are facing, and for the thoughtful approach to trying to look at those issues from a variety of angles.
That was my conversation with Northern Illinois University's Jason Klein about some of the biggest education issues you should be thinking about in 2025. Thanks so much for listening to Teacher's Lounge. As always, you can nominate a teacher in your life to be on the show. It's how we get all of our great guests. You can send them our way to teacherslounge@niu.edu. And please continue to send your story ideas so we can keep bringing you the best education coverage possible. Wherever you're hearing this, please subscribe or leave us a rating or share it with a friend so we can get even more perspectives on the show. You can subscribe to our newsletter to keep up to date with everything going on with the show over at WNIJ.org. A big thank you to the Northern Illinois band Kind Ofs for the music you hear each and every episode of this show. I've been your host, Peter Mudlin. We'll be back with more Teacher's Lounge very soon. See ya.